Any questions or thoughts that came up during the break related to what we've talked about? It is well with my soul. We understand completely, huh? Yes, Alfred.
Speaking about the implication of understanding
yeah.
the sovereignty of God.
Yeah, could you give him a microphone? Keep talking. Because I think it might be helpful to think about pastoral implications. I was having a discussion with Carlo during the break about it. And
yeah. So. Because I was just thinking, if you really understand and believe that God is sovereign, that nothing really would change anything of his plan, I think it will stop us from worrying a lot of times.
Yeah.
I think the worrying and even the guilt. And of course, there will be that, because of the sin, if that's a mistake that you made because of sin. But if it's a bad choice that resulted in something bad, right? I think it will really help us, you know, be free from a lot of our worries.
I think so, too. Yeah, Tito?
In the pastoral point of view is that I'm clinging into the very character of who my God is. No matter what his sovereign plan for me, I know that's already written and I have to know who my God is.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pastoral view.
Yeah. Yeah, Carlo?
Maybe Pastor Tiringa, you can help with this. I was asking Pastor Paul about this counselee I had who had been abused and now he started abusing. And then he threw the question at me. He's accepted Christ. He knows he's a Christian and he's really hanging on to the gospel. But he threw the question at me why he had to go through it in the first place when the end event that God wanted to do was bring him to God himself anyway. Why did it have to be such a painful process? Because it's still painful for him up till now. And I was just sharing that I really appreciate it came upon me that I really needed to grasp this, the sovereignty of God, to be able to explain it well enough to him, how he might come to grasp that as well, what he was going through. Kasi nga hanggang ngayon masakit pa rin talaga para sa kanya. So yun, that's what we were talking about.
Was that tongues?
Sorry, that's why it's so hard for him even up to now, and painful,
yeah.
Even painful.
Yeah, that's what you said. That was the interpretation of your tongues. Right? Yeah. Well, I think that's the same idea of the fortunate fall. As terrible as the fall is, just think about what we've gained, what we could never have known. God's mercy, grace, so many things about God we wouldn't know. Also, when you think about story, think how much of our life is built around story. And story requires, there's got to be a problem. Something bad happens. All art of every kind comes out of pain, comes out of a problem, something that, every story has conflict. Right? There'd be no story. There'd be no art. There'd be no drama. There'd be no victory. So much that's lost that we would never have been able to experience. And when I'm talking to someone who's experienced something, when you go through something like that, and something that's that painful, God will comfort and strengthen you in that in a way that he'll never comfort and strengthen me who didn't have to experience that. And so you'll actually get to experience something of God that I never will and that you never could have if it hadn't happened. And if we could look back from eternity, we could see that whatever we went through, no matter how horrific, what we got to know about God through it was so much more valuable it wouldn't matter what you would give me, I wouldn't trade anything for that experience. Because I got something about God. I got to experience Him in a way that I couldn't have experienced. Paul uses an interesting expression in Philippians chapter 3 when he says that I might know Him. He uses the expression in the power of His resurrection and the fellowship of His suffering. That's a really interesting phrase. You know that if you've gone through something traumatic in your life, and you meet a person who's gone through the same traumatic thing, you know there's an instant fellowship. There's an understanding, there's a partnership that you have with that person. You start to tell your story and they're going, I know exactly how you feel. And they tell you your story, you say, yeah, I know exactly how you feel. And there's a bond of relationship formed that you can't have with someone else. Someone else who's never experienced it, you might try to talk to them about it. And they try, say, well, that must have been terrible. But there's no fellowship of the suffering. And Paul says, I want to know Him. I want to fellowship with His suffering. I want to experience the suffering He experienced. So that's the only way I can know Him. I can know Him in the depth of His suffering that I can't apart from it. And when we look back in life and we look at those kind of traumatic things, we're actually going to get the fellowship with Christ's suffering through those sufferings in a way that people who didn't experience it don't get to. And once you fellowship with God over something like that, if you had a chance to undo it, you never would. You never would, no matter what. And you'll praise God throughout eternity that somehow, for some reason, in God's plan, that happened, as terrible as it was, and yet I could never have known you like this apart from that. So I think that's the pastoral implications of understanding this, ministering in the depth of people's souls, of knowing that I said to him, I really envy you. You get to know Christ in a way that I won't get to know Him. And I envy you for that experience you've had, which is a little startling to him, but maybe gets him to think differently about the experience. And then from that healing, then they're really in a position to heal and minister to others in similar situations. Other thoughts about this? Yeah, JR?
I like what you said.
Thank you, JR. I like what you say.
Because some people, when they try to counsel, comfort people, when something bad happens, they say, well, you know, pen. God will work things out and you will benefit from this. Maybe something will happen. But in the case of Job, nothing really happened. He just suffered, and then he didn't even know what hit him. But he came to know God. I like when you said, you will know God in a way that you will
you
never
couldn't have known him
before.
Yeah.
I think the benefit of it really is whether it will do something good, whether you'll prosper or not. The thing is, you get to know God in a way that you could have never known him. It's like I said, thank you, Lord, that I've experienced this. You've made me go through this, but please don't do this again.
Yeah. I think when you say that, I don't know if you fully get it. So I would say, Lord, thank you that I went through that, and thank you that I got to meet you in that way. I'm not looking forward to any other experiences like that in one sense, because I like to be comfortable. Give me a choice of pain or comfort, I'm going to take comfort every time.
That's right.
But that's just my sinful heart talking. And ultimately, I know I want your will. Because as painful as it might be at the time, I know the end result is glorious. And that's what I finally reconciled in my heart with this, is when it gets troubling, like when you look at disasters and pain and things that people go through, is I remind myself that God is love. And what that means is that every decision he makes comes out of love. That means that whatever decision he chose to make, i.e. whatever happened, that was the most loving choice that could have been made. Out of all the possibilities, there was nothing that was more loving. This was the absolute best, most loving thing that could happen. Excuse me. And that brings it into perspective. I also have to come back to that to keep myself sane when I think about all the consequences of this. Any other thoughts? Let's just finish the last few fill-ins in The Art of Persuasion, and then let's go home. I know some of you have a long commute. Mine is 7 minutes. Pray for me as you're... Yeah. 7 minutes. We were on, I think we left off on movement. Movement is useful for getting and keeping attention. I don't know if there's any better attention getter than movement. Motion always gets attention. Think about a time when you've been preaching, and you might be in one of the most dramatic parts of your message, one of the most engaging parts of your message. You know, there's certain times when you know you've got everybody right there completely engaged. They're eating out of the palm of your hand. Do you know that expression? Mm-hmm. Like, you're there, they're with you 100%. And somebody on the front row gets up and walks back. Mm-hmm. What happens to every eye in the place? Everybody just follows that person. Or something happens on stage, someone comes across, every eye follows that person. No matter how gripping your preaching is, movement trumps it every single time. In the theater, they have an expression called throwing stage. Have you heard that term? What that means is when a particular actor, it's their point for their big soliloquy, their big moment. The other people who are on stage, they have to remain very still because all the attention, the spotlight's on that person. Throwing stage is when another actor, and usually it's done out of spite, to draw the spotlight away from that person, they'll move, they'll do certain kinds of things, and it'll draw the attention of the audience. That movement on the stage immediately, I mean, it could be Hamlet's To Be or Not to Be. It doesn't matter. Movement on the stage is, everybody's attention is going in another direction. I see on television sometimes in the States, these preachers in the large churches, they got the big choir, right? And so then they speak, and they have the choir still back there. So on the television camera, you got the speaker, but you can see the people in the background. I would never do that. Because no matter how gripping or entertaining the speaker is, the people in the background, when they're moving, as soon as they'll just talk or just like something like that, your attention is immediately drawn away from the speaker. Now, knowing how powerful movement is helpful for us in getting and keeping attention. It's one of our greatest weapons against people who take trips. But you got to use it wisely. You see, if you're constantly moving, then movement doesn't help you. Matter of fact, it just becomes the whirring fan. And maybe our next fill-in, let's put that in now as we continue to talk about, avoid the abuse of excessive, and nervous movement. So you know what excessive is, and we were big on this in the early days of Maranatha. Some guys, they were like caged lions. Have you ever seen a guy like that? Just back and forth on the stage, just back and forth. No real strategy, just moving, you know, just, I guess just that's kind of energy or something. But following that, after a while, you're getting sleepy. It loses its effect. And then when you need movement, you've wasted it. That's excessive movement. Nervous movement is movement that doesn't have a strategic plan. And you know, that's just fiddling, really. Just kind of moving around and kind of going from one place to another without any real reason or purpose behind it. What I recommend for movement is if you use a podium, if you stand behind a podium, that I always try to concentrate on standing behind the podium really still for the first part of my message. Because in the beginning of the message, you don't need people's attention. Generally, you've got it. I mean, you got the first few minutes kind of guaranteed, right? They're going to check you out. They'll give you at least 2 or 3, 4 minutes in the beginning. So I'm standing still. But then at key spots, I'm going to move. And I especially am going to move at times when I am giving material that is a little bit more abstract, difficult to follow, didactic as opposed to a story. Generally, when you're telling a story, people are already engaged. I might move just for to enact the story, but you don't need movement. You need movement, really, when you're at that point where you're trying to build a couple points, foundations, and you might have a tendency to drift off. That's when you make a specific movement. And it's especially effective to go places that people don't expect you to go. There's a certain an area around the podium it's like preacher territory, okay? You go there, we expect you to do that. It's when you go outside of the expected area you really get people's attention. Now, Joey does that every Sunday. Every Sunday. And I'm sure it's strategic. He leaves the stage and he starts walking down the aisle every Sunday. Of course, they've got him on the big screen, so it works for him. But he does it in the middle. It's near the middle of the message. And sometimes he goes down both aisles. But I think it's just, he seems to hit both aisles pretty evenly. You know, I don't know if he's got a plan in that or a favorite aisle, but he seems to hit them both. When you go places you're not supposed to go, you really get people's attention, especially if you actually violate someone's personal space. Now, that's a powerful attention getter. Do you understand the concept of personal space? Really, it's a fascinating concept, isn't it? Of course, missionaries, yeah, you would know that because you've really got to be aware of that from culture to culture. Every culture has different acceptable personal space. Now, there are a lot of Hispanics in the United States, a big Latino population, and Hispanics generally are more comfortable closer to each other than white people are. It's not unusual to see two Hispanics, Dan kind of face towards me, okay? They're having a conversation, and they're like, they're this close to each other, and they're talking, two guys. Now, you're uncomfortable, aren't you?
Very.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Especially if my lips start to pucker, right? We're all uncomfortable, you see. Not Hispanics. They're real comfortable with that. Matter of fact, you do this, you know, what's the matter? You know, what's wrong? There's something wrong? You got to get close. Man, we got to talk, you know? We got to get right up there. And you know, I mean, they're like right there, and they're just talking.
No, sir.
I think there are certain cultures of the Middle East that are like that, too, right? You see men right up close to each other. And man, that's just, for an American, that's just weird. Don't try that with the Japanese even. I mean, they even need more personal space. So every culture has a certain personal space. And if you experiment, and then you just get down, you know, just with one person, that's all it takes. You know, you have to violate everyone's personal space, but you're talking, and you get real close up to someone, you just like just face to face, talk to them. Everybody in the whole place will be riveted on you and what you're going to do. And you've got their attention for a long time. So movement is very powerful, but use it wisely, use it carefully. Any thoughts about movement? How have you seen movement? Do you guys use this movement? Yeah, Alfred.
Again, like last Friday, because I use Clicker.
Clicker, yeah.
So at the 5 o'clock service, it worked really well.
The Clicker worked good?
Yeah. And at the 7 p.m., my laptop all of a sudden didn't cooperate.
Uh-huh.
So my Clicker wasn't working.
Uh-huh.
So they have to switch from from the back from the tech boot.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
they try to follow my mm-hmm. but with all my animation, it's not following with me. So
mm-hmm.
So what I did was, instead of focusing on that, so I started moving. So I started walking to the aisle and just walk to the aisle, just get the attention out of the the screen so that I can get their attention still. So that worked for me, but that day.
You know, Alfred, if you live by the sword, you're going to die by the sword. So. No, I'm sure it was good.
You should have not mentioned that. He will not use any more PowerPoints.
Oh, I never will anyway, so don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Yeah, no problem there. Okay, a couple of practical tips. May have some value, maybe not. Walk confidently onto the stage. I think that's George Whitefield, one of the great communicators of all time, when he would stand in the pulpit. Oftentimes, he was a big man with a huge, big barrel chest and powerful voice, right? Did I tell you? I don't know if it measured that he had actually spoken to 30,000 people outdoors that could hear him. So, powerful voice, could project really well, very dramatic, dynamic. He would, big meat claw for a hand, and he'd bring his hand down real loud on the podium, smack that podium when he stood up there, and he would scream out in a very powerful voice, "I have come to you with a message from God, and I must and will be heard." Boom. Well, that's certainly an attention getter, and that's certainly walking confidently on the stage. Now, we probably couldn't get by with that if we did something like that. People would probably just laugh, wouldn't they? I don't know. But I know for years, before I was introduced or before I actually got there, I would go through a George Whitefield-like routine. Just on my own, I'd go through that whole thing. I have a word from God, and I must and will be heard. Just to build that confidence that God's word's in my mouth, and His word has power, and it's going to accomplish something. And so it's the walking on stage. I'm confident. And usually I'm confessing. I have a regular prayer. I say, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, for He has anointed me to preach." So I'm meditating and thinking that thought in my mind as I'm walking on the stage. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. Starting off with that confidence. Speak clearly with good articulation, so the ends of words are heard. Make sure your posture is good. You're standing evenly balanced. Make eye contact with the whole audience, not just a particular section. That's difficult to do. Most people have a favorite side. Do you find that's true with yourself? You have to discipline yourself. And I think also a lot of our venues, it's almost 180, isn't it? I know when I speak at Malate, it's kind of a 180. So there's these two wings over here. It's very easy to forget them. I try to make a point at least once in the sermon on either side to not just turn and look at those people over there, but to actually turn my whole body, walk over to that side of the stage and face them and talk to that group for a bit. Now, not too long, but then I try to get the other side too, just to make sure everybody feels like nobody's left out, right? There's not a little part where you can kind of get by with. The eyes of God are on you no matter where you're sitting. And we're we're looking at making eye contact across the auditorium. Anybody have any techniques for doing that to make sure that you do it? Are you aware of it? Sal, what were you going to say?
Yeah.
You consciously do it?
Mm-hmm. You can actually go focus on one person in the eye.
Yeah.
With the section, you can turn to this section and that one person, you know.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like getting a good view of the audience.
Yeah.
But the trick is you can actually concentrate with one
person, yeah.
That's what I
you find one person.
Find one person who's really interested, smiling. And
that encourages you to keep going, huh?
Yeah, keep going.
What if nobody is smiling? Time to look for another job then, huh? Develop a natural presentation style. Do not copy others. Don't fold your arms or put your hands in your pocket unless it's strategic. Like there's sometimes I'm making a point. So I will do it deliberately or put my hands in my pocket for a strategic purpose. But it's just nervous movement if you're not doing it strategically. All right, that's enough for today. God bless you guys. We had a good year.